That started. Okay, so this is the UVic Military Oral History Program interview with Captain Ken Scotton, recorded on March 7th, 2011 at Captain Scotton's home, interviewed by Aaron O'Brien. And then can I just get your rank and name just for the record again?
Yeah, I'm a retired naval captain, Ken Scotton.
Right. Okay, thank you. And do I have permission to record this interview?
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, so then I thought maybe we'd just get started with some background information. From the preliminary interview form I got from you, it said you enlisted at 18.
I'm 59, okay. But I retired and I was serving my 37th year when I retired.
Okay, and did you come from a military family?
No, well, the answer to that is no. My uncle was in the Army.
Okay.
And another uncle was in the Air Force during the Second War.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So just kind of what interested you in enlisting with the armed forces and in particular
Yeah, well,
the
I was
Navy.
A pilot initially. And,
oh, wow.
And I had my private flying license, and I joined Naval Aviation.
Mm-hmm.
And I joined a venture plan. It was called the venture plan, and it was a two-year short service plan. They needed a bunch of naval pilots at that time. And I was a guy from the prairies in Winnipeg.
Mm-hmm.
And my first trip was at sea, was from here to Hawaii, to Fiji, Tahiti, Samoa, New Zealand. And I'd never seen the sea before. And I was a very impressionable young guy, Catherine. And I found a knack of driving ships. I already knew how to fly. So I decided to be in the surface Navy. Right.
Okay.
So I went on from there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I was also going to ask you, I also saw it said you were you came from Winnipeg, and just wondering what brought you to Victoria.
The Navy.
Okay.
Well, my interest was aviation.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried for the Air Force one year, the year previous to when I joined the Navy. My French wasn't good enough, so I didn't quite get my academic year, so I tried next year in the Navy. Decided, hey, they wanted pilots in this program, so I joined.
Wow. That's really interesting. So it also says that you were first posted on the HMCS Venture?
Venture, yeah. That was a training establishment, and it exists here today in Victoria. It's called the Naval Officer Training Center now, but the crest is Venture, but it was known as the training establishment HMCS Venture.
Mm-hmm.
And, that's where I trained for. It was a two-year all-professional studies,
mm-hmm.
and then we went to the fleet.
Okay.
And went to Halifax for more training. And then my first ship was on this coast.
Okay. And what was your first ship?
My first ship was HMCS Stettler.
Okay.
And I did my training on the old tribal class destroyers on the east coast.
Okay.
And then I several ships on this coast. And then I got married and my wife and I went down to the east coast and various other destroyers.
Mm-hmm.
And I eventually ended up commanding HMCS Athabascan on the East Coast.
Okay.
You know, that's many years. And then following that, I did some shore postings, and then I commanded the large supply ship Provider, which doesn't exist anymore. They've scrapped her now, but she was the first of three. We have two supply ships now, the Protector, which you may know about.
Actually, I'm interviewing a former commander of the Protector and the former captain of the Preserver as well.
Okay, you got them both, no?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know those guys. They're both colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we all work together right now.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
I was going to say.
We run the simulator at Venture.
Oh, no way. With Captain Allen?
Captain Allen, yeah.
And I'm also interviewing Commander Mays.
Yeah. Yeah, Randy Mays. Captain Allen and myself were on a ship together.
We're
both weapons officers, and Mays and I commissioned the Algonquin together. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, we're not a huge community.
Wow. And then, so pretty much, guess we'll just dive right in. Can you just kind of explain to me what happened there back in June of 1990?
Okay, in June of 1990, in fact, I was just reading. And you can read this maybe later. This is a little story by one of the survivors.
Oh, wow.
And it's from when they decided to leave Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And at sea, and my story starts when we picked them up, when we rescued them.
Mm-hmm.
And what we had done is we had finished a large exercise in the whole of the Pacific, and we had been to Korea. We had been to Vladivostok.
Okay.
Then down in Korea, and we in Hong Kong. And my wife and my son mm-hmm. joined me in Hong Kong, because my son had just graduated with his master's at Queen's.
Okay.
And this was kind of a gift, so that both of them are there.
Mm-hmm.
And we were going to, just before we entered Hong Kong, we went through one typhoon on the fringes of a typhoon. And you know what a typhoon is?
It's the beginning of a
small hurricane,
yeah.
Right? In the Pacific, they call them typhoons.
Tropical storm.
They start at Guam, and they go over in this area.
Mm-hmm.
And this was typhoon season.
Oh, okay.
So during that typhoon, we didn't know it yet, but the small boat, which mm-hmm. you saw a picture of, and I've got a disc here. We can show that on the TV. They had sailed from a small little place here, and they were headed for Malaysia.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just escaping South Vietnam for the reasons that are stated in those few pages. And you could read that maybe a little later. I might even make a copy of that.
Thank you.
So we sailed Hong Kong, and we were with three other destroyers. There was the Huron,
mm-hmm.
there was the Annapolis, and the Kootenai, and myself in Provider. And we were going, Annapolis was going to a place in, oh gosh, just north of Malaysia. Huron was going to Singapore, and I was going with Kootenai back to Manila.
Mm-hmm.
And we had sailed from Hong Kong, and we were in this general vicinity here when I was to do a final refueling for all the other ships. And then I was to turn around with Kootenai, we were to head back here. Well, it was late in the afternoon. You know, it was around supper time. We hadn't had supper yet. My son and I were in my cabin. My cabin was just aft of the bridge on the ship. And I got a report from the bridge saying that the port lookout saw something.
Mm-hmm.
And looked out, and he saw the boat, the picture of which you saw in the... And it was... I just hauled out a formation, went mm-hmm. over alongside it, and then everybody, of course, when I hauled out a formation, the other ships... said, ooh, where's he going? What's he doing? And so we went over and we saw these folks.
Mm-hmm.
And these folks had been adrift at sea for about 19 days at that point. There was 90 people on board. And that piece of paper says they started out with 104.
Oh, goodness.
So they were in really tough shape
mm-hmm.
By that time. And our first job was to embark them. So let me just grab my diary.
Sure.
Or my journal, I guess. I kept a journal of the actual messages, and that's why all the information is factual. And my son had a little PC on the desk, kept the mm-hmm. thing that I sent you.
Oh, okay.
So it's getting a little tatty, but there's the boat coming alongside.
Okay.
Okay. And can you imagine being 19 days in that, and you, when they left from here,
mm-hmm.
when they left from here, they expected to take about 4 to 5 days in this small old boat
to
get to Malaysia. Well, their engine broke down, as you can see there.
Mm-hmm.
So you can read in there. And the first job I had was to get them on board.
Mm-hmm.
Look at them.
I'm claustrophobic as it is. I would not have been able to do that.
I don't understand how that would happen. And there they are on deck, and when the wind blows, they went down underneath.
Oh, my gosh.
It's just gross. But look, these are the good ones that we got aboard and carried them all. And these are all my ship's company. So what I did is we just stopped and we tried to put a ladder down so they'd climb up, but they couldn't. Mm-hmm. We ended up putting a scrambling ladder.
Okay.
And you know what a scrambling ladder is?
I believe so.
It's just a square rope netting that you throw over the side and people climb up and down. You've seen the movies about, you know, the guys going ashore on the beaches.
Yeah.
That sort of thing.
Okay.
And I put a bunch of sailors, and they just lifted them up.
Okay.
Carried them up on board. Okay. We had everything from babies to old people. We had a real mix. We had whole families and some parts of families.
I was reading in one of the newspaper articles I pulled offline that there were 3 pregnant women there as well.
There were.
Oh,
there
my
were.
Goodness.
Oh, it was huge. And these people were really fortunate because that we came along, because you're normally a merchant ship. They couldn't have got aboard the merchant ship.
Mm-hmm.
Merchant ship has most about 20 to 25 people on board as crew, and they had nobody. I had a doctor, although he wasn't aboard at the rescue.
Mm-hmm.
I had flown him ashore. I had 2 helicopters, because one of the other destroyers, that's Huron,
mm-hmm.
but one of the other destroyers had a person who had burst appendicitis.
Oh, my goodness.
And so we flew him to the U.S. Naval Base in Subic. This happened about here.
Okay.
The day before.
Mm-hmm.
So I flew them into Subic, where the U.S. Navy had a huge, lovely facility in there. And the doctor came to me and he says, well, I said, no, you're not going ashore, doc.
Mm-hmm.
He says, yeah. He said, I said, look, you can't do anything in the airplane. When you get there, there's the doctors, they can look after them. And, you know, we got 1,000 folks out here. We had 3 ships with over 200. So around 1,000 folks.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked me into it, and I let him go.
Mm-hmm.
And that turned out to be a blessing in one sense and not in the other. In the good sense, he was ashore, and we were able to talk to him.
Mm-hmm.
So he could bring back the necessary stuff that we didn't have. Medicine.
Mm-hmm.
He brought some 4 specialists from the U.S. Navy who were specialists in tropical diseases and tropical medicine, which was a real help for us.
Mm-hmm.
But he wasn't there to start with when we really, really needed him. So there we are bringing these folks aboard. And these are all my messages. These are the actual messages I sent ashore back to Canada. Because what happened in Canada is they, as soon as this broke, they set up a tripartite committee where there was foreign affairs, there was the military, and there was the prime minister's office as well. They set up a committee to handle this. So I was talking directly to them all the time. And I embarked 90 people, and there's the Latin long. We didn't know what the problems were, what we had. We had to take stock. First, we had to get them aboard. And they were tired and sick. And here we are doing triage in the morning. This is the second morning. This is on the flight deck. And then there's the hangar. I don't know if you got a picture of the ship. Did you see a picture of the ship? What the ship looks like?
I think there was.
I sent you this picture, I think. Here we go. Well, I set them all up in the hangar.
Yeah.
Right. I set them all up in the hangar because I didn't know. I had to quarantine them from the rest of the ship's company because I didn't know what we had.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to look after these 90 people in deplorable medical condition. And so how were we going to do it? Well, we formed 3 teams, and my son was on one of the teams.
Mm-hmm.
But we had to drive the ship at the same time and still look after the ship as well as these people. So I didn't have the helicopters aboard at the beginning. So we used the whole of the hangar.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a couple of pictures in here how I set the hangar up. And then we had to, let me see. This is my first SIT trip. 90 refugees on board provider and all refugees alive, some in serious condition, had to remove from vessel by stretcher. About half of them couldn't even help themselves. And I've got one picture in here where you can see a person in the hole, and when he looked down, I thought this person was dead, but they weren't. They were still alive. We actually hoisted them in stretchers with a crane. Intend on detaching provider to Manila immediately as medical assistance from ashore essential. Both of provider's helicopters is at Naval Air Station, Cubic Bay. Few refugees speak English, and none of them spoke French, which really surprised me because Vietnam was French-speaking because of the French. It was a French colony at one time, mm-hmm. but none of these folks could speak. We had one family. There was complete family. There was two girls. You'll see her on the slide, who were real good help. They could speak just a bit of English, and that's how we communicated with the rest of them. Mm-hmm. So. There's the hangar. There's a picture of the hangar. Okay, so we cut every cot we could find mm-hmm. and laid them out. And on one side of the hangar, we had the most seriously ill. And in later pictures, you'll see we set up a medical table when we got the doctor back and everybody from. We flew them back on the two helos. Mm-hmm. And we had the good people over here really sick. We ended up with 8 people really, really sick. Okay, so my first thing is my next port of call was Manila. Mm-hmm. And where do I get rid of them? Because Manila was accepting, at that time, was accepting no refugees.
Mm-hmm.
Here's my first message. Is in, provider picked up 90 boat people on the 19th of June. I wanted to disembark them in Manila. And would be grateful if you could initiate disembarking arrangements with the Department of Foreign Affairs and the Bureau of Immigration. Also inform the UN High Commissioner for Refugees and the International Order of Medicine, which is the UN's working guys. Okay. These are the politicians. These are the guys that do all the work.
Okay.
Okay. And rest their assistance for processing arrangements. I didn't know what time I was going to get there. I depend on the medical condition of the 5 currently critical cases. This is still the 19th. 5 critical cases. I knew I would need, medical attention, medical capabilities beyond what I could provide. Because I had a senior chief who was a medical assistant. Mm-hmm. I had a female leading seaman who was a medical assistant, and I had the petty officer from the ship that came with me. So I only had 3 trained medics. Oh, I had a dentist.
Okay.
Okay, he was on board Huron. He wanted to go to Singapore, and I said, no, doc, you've got medical skills that I may need, so you get over here. So I took him with me. So those are the only people I had. Until the doctor flew back.
Okay.
I mean, the first thing that happened, the kids sprang back immediately. They were mm-hmm. dehydrated. They needed food and attention. They had bugs that were, well, you read my son's report, eh?
Yes.
They were all over the place. Mm-hmm. But the kids sprang back right away. And what do you do with 90 people? And you only can find them up to here, so it became, not only do you have to look after them, you have to entertain them. And they weren't dumb, okay? Mm-hmm. They knew they were in, they weren't going to die. Well, it turns out the first one did die the first night.
Mm-hmm.
This is my report. Regret to report the first fatality occurred on the 19th at 1500 Zulu, which would be, let me see, that would be in the evening. Mm-hmm. Was after supper. Male, approximately 50-year-old, called the death, assessed the dehydration and malnutrition. We buried him at sea. I've never done a burial at sea in my life before, but we were going to do our first one. We did it in the morning. And my son talks about that very much so. And you'll see it on the and it was rainy, just like in the movies. I slowed the ships down. We had a ceremony, and I had a padre on board. He was, because we were taking some supplies for some of the other places there, and so we had a military padre. He was Roman Catholic, and he was going to the Philippines, and he conducted the ceremony, and I put him in a bag, just like they do in the old movies, on a board in the fence, and say a few prayers, and I just tip him over and pipe the side as done in military. Let's see, and I just recorded it. You'll see it in the... But his wife had is one of the ones who, in that report, she died before she was rescued.
Okay.
He had... his son was... had died at... He was one of the other casualties on the boat before he was rescued as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a 12-year-old girl who we brought out on the flight deck because we had the burial ceremony down in the quarter deck, just below the flight deck, so she could witness it. And she was crying, and there she was in the rain, you know, alone in the world now. She was a real sad case, and the press got on, tried to follow her. And she was a sad case. There she was, crying her eyes out. There's her dad, and she's lost everybody who... She lost her whole family in this thing, and she's alone now, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know who's going to look after her. As an aside, she escaped from the camp that they put her in Manila, and we don't know what happened to her.
Oh, wow.
Nobody knows. She just ran off, so you really don't know. Let me see. Well, here's the medical table. All the people here that were, they lost all their own clothes.
Mm-hmm.
They were, this was home to them. And behind this table contained medicine and stuff that the medical people had set up. And behind them were the eight people who were seriously ill. And then we set up, you know, a food station, brush your teeth station, brought TVs up for the kids, had people entertaining the kids, singing songs, singing for Jacques and all that sort of stuff. It was really... And then the second night, we lost another person. Let me see. Our responses to the medical semester. Okay, this is where the doctor is ashore, and I sent this message to the Naval Air Station at Cubic Point to tell my doctor. Boat people have been at sea since the 31st of May, departed from Cao Mau, South Vietnam, which is not on your map, but it's right down here.
Okay.
Okay. One died during the night. Presently, you have 58 males, 31 females, of which 13 children receiving medical treatment. Four people on IV therapy. We had one woman who was pregnant. She gained 15 pounds in 15 hours. That's how dehydrated she was.
Oh, my God.
Because when you read that, which you should before you go, mm-hmm. you could probably make a copy of it. One male in critical condition suffering from dysentery and hypometric shock. I don't know what that is. Eye infections and various skin diseases. So we told them what to bring. Sorted IV suit and gamma globulin because there was hepatitis in that crowd as well.
Oh, no.
So we all got shots of gamma globulin. So we had to bring enough for all. Already, I had some on board, but not enough.
Mm-hmm.
And TB was there. We knew that was the case. So here's some more of the kids. Just young kids, eh? They sprang. Mm-hmm. And they had all their clothes, all their valuables they brought because they were escaping. They were bringing all their hard currency with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a container box, and so we just put all their valuables in this one big container, wrapped it up in plastic, and put it away because it was full of bugs and everything else. But that was their valuables, and we were going to give those over when we finally landed them, because
mm-hmm.
they had no place to store them. Let me see. What else have I got? This is one of the American medical staff that came back with us. See, young kids?
Yeah.
Our ship's company, if they bought T-shirts and stuff for their kids,
mm-hmm.
they gave them to these kids.
Aww.
Oh, yeah, old presents. Because we had been at sea for a long time by then.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, here's where I said that we... Okay. Here's the message I sent as soon as I got my medical guy. My both health coppers came back because I flew the helicopters in pairs because if I had an accident with one helicopter, there was no way they were going to get rescued.
Mm-hmm.
So I went them two together so that if one had an accident, the other one would pick them up and they'd fly ashore. You know, we wouldn't save lives. So that's how we were. The medical officer, my doctor, told me when he arrived back here that the local admiral from the base called him aside just before he got on back on our airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
That he said, you can't bring them here. In other words, you can't bring them to the U.S. medical facilities. Okay, you got to take them somewhere else. We're not going to allow you to do that. So that was an aside to me. Well, that's normal because that whole area was chronic with these people, right?
Okay.
All right. And we had a couple of things working in our favor. One is when we left, when we were in Hong Kong, we had the normal diplomatic cocktail party, and one of the persons that was at the cocktail party was the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Ambassador Stoltenberg, who was a Norwegian. And we had asked the embassy staff in Manila to come to Hong Kong to brief us, because at that time, the Americans and the Philippines were not on friendly terms because of all the problems around Subic Bay, the big naval air station.
Mm-hmm.
There, and they weren't getting any leave. So we said, hey, what kind of problems are that? So we had this guy called Andrew McAllister. He was one of the first secretaries of the Canadian Embassy in Manila. So we had him on board. And it was really nice because he could advise me, and we could talk directly over the radio with our ambassador in Manila. And as it turned out, he was able to get to Stoltenberg before he got to the Philippine Prime Minister, who was Mrs. Aquino.
Mm-hmm.
And it was his intervention that ultimately, with Mrs. Aquino, that ultimately let us land the people in Manila. Because I was told by an exclusive message from Ottawa, while I was still at sea, that, hey, you may have to bring them home. Where they had a Hercules on standby, and they were going to fly it to Manila and maybe bring them back that way, because the Philippine government initially weren't going to take them, so we were going to be stuck with them, which would have been a real sweat. Can you imagine me bringing home 90 kids? And we don't know what kind of disease on board, so I'd formed these caregiver teams to look after them, and I wouldn't let any of our food preparation people into the hangar at all. I did that because if they had something that was really chronic or dangerous, like hepatitis, we didn't want it to spread anywhere. So they were really upset, because the compassion shown by the ship's company to these people was they bonded with them.
Mm-hmm.
Guys, I wonder, can I sponsor this family? They're great kids. Because they were just young kids, eh? And
mm-hmm.
families and partial families and that sort of thing. And when we went into the hangar, I had set up a solution that you walk through. And when I went up there into the hangar, I wouldn't touch anything, but I'd walk through the solution all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And our folks always wore these things, and they went through an isolation procedure in and out of the hangar.
Mm-hmm.
So to try and keep whatever the problem was there,
mm-hmm.
up there. See, the young kids came back quickly. This was the petty officer from the other ship, a medical guy, great guy, is helping, because these guys went flat out. There was three medical people, and the doctor came back, and they lived in these. I would tell them about this, and I had a guy filming it all on VHS,
mm-hmm.
and here's a message sent to Ottawa. I would like to bring to the attention of the higher authority the fact that the response of the ship's company to this humanitarian emergency has been truly outstanding and in the best traditions of the service. People responded willingly in the most professional and compassionate manner, giving of themselves in their time, effort, and absolutely invaluable and needed assistance to people in great need. Even personal clothing was provided when the supply of coveralls and other embarked clothing ran out. Their compassion in assisting medical staff in processing and in acting as caregivers on a continuous basis in the feeding, cleaning, dressing, processing, and continually administering to these people is an example of all which fills me with intense pride as their commanding officer. So this is me telling Otto, but what the hell's going on here?
Mm-hmm.
HMCS Kootenai was the other ship. Steamy and Company has also given clothing and offered assistance. Provider is preparing for it and appreciates that this situation could exist for some time. Well, I was telling them, I said, okay, I understand that we could have these people for a while. My job was to lead the ship's company and prepare for this. Hey, we may have these folks for a long time, so let's do it in a compassionate way. Because they had nothing. All they had was their own self-respect, so we gave them every courtesy we could. And then I was talking about how many names come to mind for who provided outstanding service in this situation. But I would like to bring to the attention, to your attention, the service provided by the medical assistants. They're from provider, it's the Master Officer Kearns, Corporal Brown, Debbie Brown, and from Kootenai Petty Officer Law, who was transferred to provider at the start of this incident. They have without doubt saved lives by their service, which has been nonstop for in excess of 36 hours and continues still. Their service has been without the guidance of the ship's medical officer, who had been previously flown ashore with a serious medevac from Annapolis, and was one of the other destroyers who was no longer with me. I would like to bring to their attention the service of the supply officer provider. And I told our supply officer, I was the lieutenant commander, Major Quillen, I said, you organize the hangar, you run it, and you support the medical guys. You know, what they need, they get.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was great. But look at the young kids, eh? What do you do with young kids like that, eh? And these people had been on that little boat, eh?
Mm-hmm.
What else did I have? Well, here's one of my things. Oh, this is the medical situation report that I thought we should tell all the doctors. Now, I got my doctor back by this time.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened when the doctor was back? I had two airplanes to land. So the helicopters there was another typhoon in this area. I was about here now. I refueled them. I was heading back this way. And my helicopters had a long flight, and there was another typhoon. Orphelia. There was Nathan and Orphelia. I've got some diagrams to show you. And I was getting fuel from an American supply ship. This had long been planned.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 8 hours alongside this American supply ship getting water and fuel, because I'm a tanker.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the things. I get enough to get all those other ships home, gas to get them home. And so my helicopter's with the doctor and all these medical supplies that I've been talking to him with on the phone, and the four people, the airplanes flew back. So I had to land one helicopter on the flight deck. So I had to clean all the stuff I had off the flight deck, fall back into the hangar, land one airplane.
Mm-hmm.
Then I had to fold the blades and move them into the hangar. So we had to move everybody in the hangar over on one side to land the second helicopter on board. And this was a long flight, so I detached the other destroyer and sent him back halfway. And with his radar, talked to him. He acted as a shepherd for the two airplanes because they actually got beyond something they're not supposed to do. They got beyond the range. They got more than halfway of their fuel expended,
mm-hmm.
and they couldn't have gotten back if they couldn't find me.
Oh, no.
So that's what I used the other destroyer for. So that was a chance they took. Anyway, here's the medical report that I sent with the doctor here. And the second night I had another death aboard, and we buried him at sea. So there was two people died, one the first night and one the second night. So the doctor is now back on board. Well, the hangar is now starting to look more like a refugee camp than an emergency hospital. That's because all the kids and everybody were responding quickly. 12 patients severely dehydrated and require IV rehydration. 4 cases of pneumonia on IV antibiotics. 70% of patients have diarrhea, many with bloody diarrhea. Suspected meningitis in 4 or 5 people. Many parasitic infections, both internal and external. And 10 mass cleansing and deworming. Ugh, gross. Significant malnutrition in over 80%. Multiple ear and eye infections. And eye infections, the medical staff told me, were the first signs of really malnutrition and dehydration. Your eyes start to cloud. Suspect a third pregnant individual. I was treating all the ship's company with gamma globulin. Now, what happened is they brought enough gamma globulin in the helicopters for all ship's company. It's just a quick little injection you get, which helps, gives you some sort of a prophylactic against it. And I continue isolating the both people in the hangar. Okay, so we go on. Here's that petty officer doctor I explained to you. Oh yeah, this is, my son was involved in, this was the guy, this is septicemia.
Oh wow.
That's an extremely dangerous blood poisoning.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an ulcer from seawater. And it was packed full of feces and stuff at the beginning. Oh, it was gross. I thought, my son was part of the team that had to clean this guy out. Now he survived, actually.
But look
at the size of the hole.
Yeah,
right?
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, so that's the kind of stuff. Now, can you imagine going on an emergent ship where they've got no medical staff other than, you know, a box in the corner? These guys were very fortunate that we picked them up. Okay, so then we're talking back and forth between, I'm sending to Manila, require the following medical personnel to meet the ship on arrival. Pediatrician, officer, dermatologist, tropical medical specialty, and people require hospitalization. Okay. And there's this other guy here. Oh yeah, here we are. This is another of the medical reports which amplified it. IV and oral rehydration program showing results. Both people in much brighter spirits on the whole. Now this is what? This is the 20th. This is day 2. 19th picked them up. 20th and 21st. Canadian had hands full with falling patients. Likely septicemia. That was this guy.
Mm-hmm.
2 probable meningitis. 1, because you can't, without a lab, you can't diagnose meningitis, but they were pretty sure it was. 1 possible bacteria, which means it's very infectious.
Mm-hmm.
2 pneumonia responding to therapy. 3 bloody diarrhea with drink. Several very weak and ill-appearing patients, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, it goes on. So I picked up my fuel, got the doctors from the other ship. Oh, yeah. So I got to Manila, and Manila has a big bay. I don't know if it doesn't show you that well. Let me grab my atlas and I'll just show you if I don't think I got it. Like this other typhoon, so I'm in the bay with the ship, and I get my pilot, the Philippines Navy pilot, and he's going to help me go alongside. And the harbor of the Philippines in Manila is a big bay, and there's an island called Corregidor. Remember, you may or may not have heard your father's an Army guy. Eh?
Air Force.
Okay. Air Force?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Corregidor was where the Americans, where MacArthur left when the Second World War.
Okay.
So it's a big bay, Manila Bay.
Okay.
Well, this typhoon, I tried to get alongside. Mm-hmm. So there I am making my approach, and I get this pilot who I didn't have a lot of confidence in his ability because he didn't see, He didn't, you know, you talk to people, they should know nautical things. Mm-hmm. The weather was blowing really hard. I'm a steam-driven ship with one engine, one rudder, no bow thruster, and I've got to get in with high winds and a storm because the second typhoon remnants are still around. And I make my approach, and I said, I got the pilot aboard, wasn't happy, so I cancel it. I said, it's just too dangerous to go alongside, because the last thing I needed, there I was. I could see where I was supposed to go. I could see the berth. I could see the press people on the jetty. They were about a mile and a half away. And I said, So we went out and anchored in the bay. I'll just show you if I can. Manila. I should have brought it up on the Google it. Manila. Oh, it's probably still going to be too. And there's the big bay, eh?
Okay.
There's Manila,
mm-hmm.
Corregidor. So I anchored right in the bay. It's fairly shallow. We stayed the night there, and the winds were blowing like stink. And these guys were really seriously ill. And we had started out from Hong Kong,
mm-hmm.
Come down here. The rescue took place about here. I refueled the other ships. I flew my airplanes in from here, picked them up there. Then we went back to Manila. The other ships went on to other places.
Mm-hmm.
So, due to excess high winds, aftermath of typhoon, unable to enter Manila this time. So we anchored in the bay. And then, here was the immediate message sent to Ottawa. Embarked the pilot and attempted entry into Manila Harbor due to excessive winds, unable to enter the harbor. So we anchored. Do not predict alongside Manila until the following morning, unless winds subside before sunset, because I wouldn't do it at night.
Mm-hmm.
No status, do-do-do-do. And I had video coverage. Okay, so. This is from our ambassador in. Wait, here it is. The ambassador met this morning with Stoltenberg. He was that UN High Commissioner for Refugees, along with the ambassador and other resettlement countries. Stoltenberg is scheduled to meet President Aquino today and will raise the issue of the Vietnam provider with her. At this time, do not have authorization to disembark refugees upon arrival in Manila. So I was going to go alongside, but I couldn't get rid of the refugees.
Mm-hmm.
As a result of the morning meeting, press has learned of the presence of refugees on provider, and the Canadian press are also pursuing the story. Ambassador reckons we allow the CTV reporter Kathleen Barnes. Okay, yeah, I met her with crew to board provider on arrival in Manila. He believed the publicity would assist us in obtaining the necessary authorities to embark the people because it was getting worldwide attention. And that helped a lot. And this is where I was really lucky to have the diplomatic guy from our embassy, mm-hmm. on board here from Hong Kong to Manila. And we were talking, I was talking with her, you know, the radio directly with our ambassador. And this other guy was helping me out as well, et cetera. And they were concerned about the meningitis, all the people, you know, for sure. Let me see, what else? Here's a reply I got from Ottawa. Understand your concern to land refugees as soon as possible, primarily for their own health, but also for valid operational reasons and the health of your own ship's company. Be assured that all possible steps are being taken with the three departments concerned to expedite the disembarkation of everybody. Three ministers are actively involved. So that would be the Defense Minister, Minister of External Affairs. I don't know what other minister it was. Committee is meeting often. So what was happening now is the local admiral here was cut out of the loop. I was talking directly with everybody in Ottawa. That's who I was reporting to.
Oh, wow.
The bottom line is that Ambassador Samard, he was our ambassador in the Philippines, mm-hmm. efforts have met with frustration and little progress. It is assessed that the government of the Philippines will not provide an unequivocal answer on disembarkation either upon or soon after your arrival. Even after several hours of delay, the Philippine reaction may only be in the next CITREP and a graduated response. I didn't know what that meant. They'd come and talk to us, but you have to keep them. They didn't even want us to come, but we already had approval to go there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the rest is junk. And there's me with one of the guys. Oh, and here was we're at anchor in the approaches to Manila Harbor. The weather has not abated, and in the past 6 hours, neither the harbor pilot, I couldn't even get the pilot off the vessel. The wind was so strong that the big tugs couldn't get him off, so he stayed on board. And a merchant vessel was blown aground, so it was the right decision to anchor and not go alongside.
Yeah.
Now I have two critical medical situations. What had happened was, of those very critical people, one had developed an allergic reaction to some of the stuff they were giving him. So he was really critical. And the only way I could have got them ashore was fly them off in a helicopter at night. And I didn't really want to do that if I could avoid it. Because we were close enough. We were anchored in, we were in the harbor. At present time, provider's medical officer is communicating with the embassy medical officer over a marine band radio, unsure of the nature of their illness and who they are vice the care, the treatment and the medicine. I had to balance what care would they get ashore in this place vice what I could give them. And I didn't want to separate families either, so I didn't want to send people ashore in piecemeal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I couldn't send them ashore at night. And then here was a message I sent, which was really a good thing I sent it. I am very concerned that landing of only the most serious cases. I've been told by the radio that we might get approval to land the most medically serious case. I'm very concerned that the landing of the most serious cases may be interpreted literally, and that family groups will be split up with no guarantee of reuniting. For example, one serious patient is one of two orphans whose father was the first fatality on board, and the mother, to the best of her knowledge, died and was cast overboard prior to being rescued by provider. Another case is of a young boy with severe pneumonia, another complication, whose father is recovering well on board. I would be most reluctant to send him ashore without his father. The current seriously ill critical numbers of patients fluctuates between 4 and 6, but includes family units. But if you include the family units, it's as high as 10. It should also be noted that by Canadian medical standards, many more patients would be hospitalized given the larger number of malnutrition, dehydration, and other medical conditions. What I'm saying there is, hey, we're giving the best we can, but you know, if this was any place in Canada or any kind of Western, they'd all be in a hospital. Okay. Request the support of a very strong recommendation of myself and that of my medical officer to maintain family units intact. Consider this humanitarian requirement justifies even serious cases remaining aboard. Ambassador Samard, in a radio discussion, indicated support for this position. And had I not done that, Because when we did get alongside, I was able to land the medical people, but nobody else. But they did take the family units. So had I not done that, we would have had separated them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Okay, so here I finally got alongside in Manila, and there I am alongside the pier here, and they got some hospital stuff. And so we're landing the most serious cases. It's interesting because I got alongside, two things happened in the morning when the wind abated and we were able to get alongside. I still had this incompetent pilot from the Philippines, he really was, on the tug. Mm-hmm. And we were going alongside, and I had an incident when I was not alongside the pier, and the wind was blowing, and I was up on my pilot's position, and we were giving instructions to the tugs, and I turned to the pilot, and I said, "Pilot, that tug is pushing too hard up forward. I want you to stop him." And I couldn't find him. And this guy had gone down one day because his radio broke. He didn't tell me he was gone. So I was there, I was with hand signals with this tug. We almost had an incident berthing, but we didn't. When we get alongside here, here's just me alongside, and we were there for about an hour, and we were starting to disembark when my navigator came running to me. And he said, "Sir, I just told the engineer to start jettisoning water. We don't have enough water underneath us at low tide. We got to move." So there I am, safely alongside, and I get this crisis. What had happened is the pier, now this is a vertical, you've got the pier, the bottom of the ocean, the water, and the stuff had been in the harbor so much that it had spilled this way.
Oh, okay, no.
So when I was alongside in that low water, I would have gone aground and the ship might have gone like this. So what I had to do is once I got all these sick people ashore, we pull this up, get the tugs back, get this incompetent pilot back, held us off, and I put Kootenay in as a fender. Yeah, because she was still out at anchor. She came alongside, okay. And then we berthed on her, and that worked. But, you know, there I was, safely alongside, and I figured, hey, this problem over, but it wasn't. Mm-hmm. And here it is, here's the message. It's a meat message. Provider proceed alongside Pier 15 at this time, and embark embassy officials, Philippine quarantine staff, because they quarantined the ship initially.
Oh, okay.
And the news media personnel, but due to insufficient water under the keel that alongside berth predicted for later in the day, I have to shift ship with Kootenay proceeding alongside on provider outboard of Kootenay. Prior to shifting ship, 13 Vietnamese boat people were disembarked, 7 patients, 6 relatives, next of kin to the hospital for the medical treatment. So I was able to achieve getting that most seriously ill, short of medical, had to keep the rest, and then I didn't go aground because we saved. Okay. Now, I then, because Ambassador Stoltenberg spoke to them, mm-hmm. spoke to Mrs. Aquino, I finally got approval to get. And here's the list we actually used. One of my officers took, and these are his check marks. And I say, these are all the people. The family script, I had age, there's 48, 6-year-old, 37, 6 years old, 7-year-old, 4-year-old.
Oh, wow.
This guy died. These are family groups, and then these are individuals. This is the other guy that died the second night. And these comments afterwards is actually went back to Saigon. Now, here was the story, and I couldn't tell them at the time, but the ambassador and this Anderson, that in order for the Philippine government to allow them, Canada had to guarantee that they would look after them if the Philippines couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the guarantee that Canada gave the Philippine government. Well, you can be a political refugee,
mm-hmm.
but you can't be an economic refugee. And if you're an economic refugee, you don't qualify for refugee status. In other words, you can't escape poverty. You can, you know, if you were one of the, because Vietnam had fallen to the communists at that time, and if you were sort of in the old government, you were a bad guy from the communists. So yeah, it was a political refugee. But if you just wanted to get out of the country because you had no economic future, that wasn't. You could not be a refugee. Canada still doesn't. And Canada says that if that's the case, Canada is one of many countries that repatriates those people, so you go back to your country. In other words, you just can't get out of a country and try and claim status in another country because you're poor. So, and one of the families that had this family right here all went back to Saigon. All were repatriated, and they were the ones that helped us. And they had young teenagers. But this is the whole family escaping poverty, and they were really wonderful people. And it was really—I didn't know that until the end. And had I told these people, they could have refused to leave the ship, mm-hmm. and I couldn't legally throw them out. Oh. But I didn't want to tell them. I couldn't tell them that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so then. So then they were landed. They were taken to a camp on an island in Palawan, which is very close. But this is the night before. We're at anchor in the Philippines Harbor. Okay, and we still got this whole drama going on. And I was up in my camp playing cards with a few guys, right, and my son. And I got a call. You got to come to the hangar right away. Well, I went back to the hangar, and they had printed this sign up,
mm-hmm.
which is "Thank you, Captain Scott and Provider," you know, that sort of thing. And it was a really nice ceremony. There it is up there, hey. Okay, and I came back to the hangar. And then, because it was all over, I started to get all sorts of congratulations, etc., 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 and attaboys and stuff. And it just continues on and on. So, what I'm going to do right now, I mean, let me find some of the other weather stories. We had a reunion. We had one reunion 5 years afterwards. I was going to show you the typhoon. There's some of the pictures here. Oh, yeah, there it is. People coming aboard.
Oh, wow.
It was international news
mm-hmm.
at the time. So This is the actual facsimile that I get. See, there's Ophelia. This is the tropical storm.
Mm-hmm.
That's the second tropical storm.
Oh, wow.
And this is the other one, Nathan, that had first caused their boat to have an accident.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a Nathan here. It was on the 20th of June. That broke their ship down. And this is Ophelia. This is the one that interfered with me going alongside. So I just kept all that. That was, yeah. And this is landing them once we get in there. But look at the boat.
Oh, wow.
And in the rough seas, and you'll read that,
mm-hmm.
all those people were under this deck. And can you imagine? I don't know how they did it. I really don't. So this is their arrival, and they're coming alongside.
Mm-hmm.
And these people are so full of joy now because they know we're going to take them ashore. And in that paper, you'll see where a Japanese merchant ship come right alongside them like we did and then left them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there's the helicopter on deck right from Manila. There's a burial at sea.
Okay.
You'll see it better in the film.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and then all sorts of... I just kept all this stuff. It's all confidential. Like, what the hell? There are also... letters from people. Well, I won't show you if you'll need any of that. And then we did an after action report and stuff. That's the medical guy from Kootenai and one of the young kids. Isn't that a nice picture?
That's an awesome picture.
Yeah.
I think I read that article.
Did you?
Yeah, I think it's one of the articles I pulled off. the internet
yeah.
when I was doing my historiography paper.
Yeah, yeah, there was a lot of press at the time, and I tried to get some too, and I find it hard to get now in the Google and stuff. Let's
yeah.
see, what else have I got in here? Well, this is back in Canada. This guy here, okay, this is our reunion, 5 years, okay. This was the senior pilot
oh.
in the helicopters.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the little girls was on the
uh-huh.
ship, right? We had a reunion on
mm-hmm.
board the ship. So he was great. Al Jasper was his name.
Mm-hmm.
Then we had all sorts of the airplanes. That was a long flight. Well, this one, the letters from there. Oh yeah, I'm reading that. It's just an interesting letter. They're back in Canada. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to go up and get us a cookie. So, and then I'll set up the tape. And that's, would you like a pop or water or
A glass of water would be lovely.
Okay, I'll get you. And read that. And then this is the letter. This tells the story
mm-hmm.
from Vietnam to when I rescued them.
Okay.
So you might just want to have a couple of reads of that as well.
Okay, thank you very much.